Tarzan of the Apes, brought to you from out the pages of Edgar Rice Burroughs' amazing book.
Bless me, Professor. There seems to be someone approaching.
That's Philander. How often must I tell you that?
But I think I am a
Philander. I now find you guilty of a flagrant breach of courtesy in interrupting me to call attention to a mere quadruped of the genus Felis. As I was saying...
Heaven, Professor. A lion?
And if you insist on using slang, yes, a lion. Reprehensible. I shall most certainly report this outrageous breach of ethics to the directors of the adjacent zoological gardens.
Let's go now.
Numa's roar carries to Tarzan as he sits on a low-hanging branch watching the hut. It's the roar of the king beast as he crouches, horny belly hugging the ground before the steaming muscles propel him in terrific force upon his helpless prey. Tarzan springs to his feet. He leans forward, grasps the tough stem of a trailing vine. His knees bend as he pulls the vine toward him. His feet seem to grip the rough bark of the branch. His strong hands work their way down the vine. He crouches like a sprinter at the mark, and with one glance across the clearing, gauges his distance. He tenses, thrusts himself out into space. In a wide swinging arc, he crosses the clearing. He lets go. He flies through the air, 10, 20 feet. His arms reach out. He catches another branch, hangs on, drops again, down, down, down. He sees Numa crouch, hips curled back, tiger-like fangs bared. Tarzan's feet touch a branch for 3 seconds. He sees Porter, Philander, quake with terror. They stagger toward a tree. Porter trips. He throws out his arms to catch his balance. He falls. Tarzan, with grace and skill beyond the dreams of any wire walker, runs out the branch. It's only a few feet from the ground. He bends down, drops, catches the branch with his left hand. His right hand shoots out. He grips Porter by the arm, pulls him off the ground. Numa's tail is twitching. Her ears are almost flat against her head. The greenish-yellow eyes gleam viciously. Tarzan lifts Porter to the branch. Satisfied that the professor is hanging on, he reaches for Philander. Numa screams. Philander clutches desperately at the branch. He touches it. The lion is within inches of Tarzan's foot. The ape-man feels a hot, pungent breath. The brute's mouth is open. Rasp-like tongues press hard against gleaming teeth. He snarls. Numa's jaws close with a vicious snap. The coarse, bristling hairs on top of the beast's head brush Tarzan's feet. Tarzan draws his knees up and level with his chin, swings himself to safety. Back in Tarzan's hut, Jane Porter and Clayton are trying to make their jungle home as comfortable as possible.
There. Take a look at this, Jane.
Oh, that's fine. Now I can use the cupboard for our dishes. If tin mugs can be classed as dishes.
Well, it isn't much to look at, but it's the first shelf I ever made, and I'm quite proud of it. At least it won't come down.
You know, we are badly in need of something to sweep with. Do you think you could make a long-handled broom?
Why, yes, I think so. Let me see. Why, I can tie a bunch of these feathery leaves to a reasonably straight branch.
Oh, that would be perfect. I can put up with almost anything but these enormous spider webs on the beams and in the corners. You know, Cecil, I've been thinking about that warning we found on the door.
So have I. Tarzan of the Apes. Who on earth can he be? And why haven't we seen him?
Well, as to that, I have no more idea than you have. But what I can't understand is how anyone could live in this hut and not bury the skeletons we found here.
It is very strange. I can make nothing of it. That note, signed,
Tarzan of the Apes is the most mysterious thing. By the way, if you have no objection, I would much rather make the petition for your room out of sailcloth.
Oh, I have no objection. In fact, I feel that I'm getting altogether too much consideration, having a room all to myself.
But that's just it. If I put this sailcloth on some sort of a roller, we can put it down at night, and then in the daytime we still have the same amount of room.
Why, I think that's a clever idea. Tell me, have you ever been shipwrecked before?
No, but I'll let you in on a secret. For the first 10 years of my life, my sole ambition was to join Robinson Crusoe on his desert island. Well, this isn't getting on with the work. What?
The ship is gone.
Gone?
Dead. Look.
Well, there goes our last link with civilization.
I don't know whether to be glad that those mutineers are gone, or to be sorry to see the last of the ship.
Well, of course, as long as they were here, our lives were in constant danger. But I suppose we all felt that the ship represented some sort of contact with the outside world.
And the treasure. I wonder if they found that.
That depends on whether or not Captain Casey found the map.
And if he did, I suppose Young killed him.
Oh, now,
I know, but I feel responsible. If I hadn't thrown that map overboard...
We would all have been killed. And for all we know, Tracy may be right here in the jungle.
The jungle? Oh, I do hope Father and Mrs. Philander don't wander too far away. You know, they're as helpless and thoughtless as two children.
Oh, I think they're able to look after themselves. And now, Jane, where do you want me to put the clothes, right? You know, if the white ants ever get into them, well... It's goodbye clothes.
Well, there's really not much choice. I think over here by the bunk is as good a place as any, don't you?
Then over here by the bunk it is.
What are you going to use the clothes for?
I have that all figured out. Whoever the previous occupants of the hut were, they had a good supply of carpenter tools. While this saw is a bit rusty, the saw this branch I selected, and I think when I finish, yes, I'm quite sure I'll have a perfectly good clothes rack. Now, work.
But your Robinson Crusoe ideas are certainly standing up in good stead.
I could do a much better job if I had some decent nails.
Have you used the ones from the packing case?
Yes, I have. But after pulling them out and trying to straighten them on rough stone, they bend too easily.
Well, I think you're doing wonders.
Well, I'm not much of a carpenter, but I guess they'll do it. My, that's warm work, Jane. Yes. What is it?
Look here.
What?
Up on this shelf.
What? What?
Oh, way up here in this corner. What I didn't notice them before.
Book? What sort of book?
Well, they're so dusty. But this one looks rather like a diary. Cecil, look.
John Clayton. London.
Your uncle, Lord Greystoke?
Yes.
But how do you account for these things being here in this savage African jungle?
Well, there's only one explanation. Instead of being lost at sea, as we have believed he was, Greystoke died here. I wonder what happened to the famous Greystoke locket.
What locket?
A diamond-studded locket that has been in the family for generations. It was always presented to the bride of a Greystoke at her wedding ceremony.
I'm sorry, Cecil. I'm awfully sorry. There seems to be nothing here but the book.
Yes. Of course.
course. The locket would have been Lady Greystoke.
She was called the beautiful Lady Alice, wasn't she?
Yes.
I've seen her portrait, you know, in the gallery at the Manor.
Well, this explains a lot of things and leaves a lot of other things unexplained.
Why? What do you mean?
I mean, this diary proves conclusively that they were not drowned. What happened to the crew of the vessel? How did Lord and Lady Greystoke come to this place? Were Lord and Lady Greystoke the sole survivors? Or is history repeating itself, as it so often does? Did their crew mutiny and put them ashore?
Perhaps the diary will tell us.
Oh, well, I rather think the famous locket has been worn for the last time by the bride of a Greystoke.
Your father's blender. Quick, give me that rifle. Take me out yourself and bar the door out.
We hope that you've enjoyed this recording. And for more happy listening, please visit otrcat.com.